People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Why would pediatricians be concerned about their patients' housing? Well, that's easy. Because, and I quote, a safe, decent, affordable home is like a vaccine. It literally keeps children healthy. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing, we'll be focusing on the impact of housing insecurity on children's health with Dr. Megan Sandel, whose quote I just shared. Dr. Sandel is an associate professor of pediatrics and public health at the Boston University Schools of Medicine and Public Health, is a co-principal investigator at Children's Health Watch, a policy research center, and is the medical director of the National Center for Medical Legal Partnership. She's the former pediatric medical director of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program and is a nationally recognized expert on housing and child health. Dr. Sandel, welcome to our podcast, and thank you on behalf of the affordable housing community for your research and your tireless advocacy.
Well, thank you, Joanne, for having me today.
Sure. We know that housing matters to children, and housing policy ends up having particular impact on young children's health, their growth and development. What specifically are your gravest concerns?
Well, I think that particularly for young children in the 0 to 3 range, they're growing the brain they're going to have for the rest of their life. I mean, that's when you have the largest brain growth. And so when we think about what housing means to children, I really do talk about a safe, decent, affordable home. Those three components as being really essential to healthy housing. And when we think about what that means, if you are having to choose between rent and eating, you aren't going to be growing your body. You aren't going to be growing your brain. If you're worried about cockroaches in your house, then you are going to potentially be wheezing more and have more asthma and not be as healthy. And, you know, obviously safety is a real important thing, whether it be from domestic violence or being in a neighborhood that's unsafe. And all of these things, we know as pediatricians, there's really good medical evidence that these exposures are going to be really bad. And so we talk a lot about young children as being a really important group to invest in because they're our economic future.
It's interesting because we think of homelessness and often we don't stop to think about the far more prevalent issue of housing insecurity. How would you actually define housing insecurity?
Yeah. So housing insecurity is a concept where there are a lot of people that are either overcrowded, they're doubling up because of economic reasons. They can't afford an apartment on their own, so they're living with multiple families in units that are potentially a lot smaller than what they ought to be. Or they are actually moving frequently. They're staying with one family, and then 6 months later, they're staying with another. We actually define it as 2 or more moves in a year as being kind of frequent moving. And what we've shown through our research at Children's Health Watch is that those different forms of housing insecurity, either overcrowding, which is kind of a moderate housing insecurity, or these frequent moves 2 or more times in a year, a severe form of housing insecurity, have huge effects on child health, their likelihood of getting hospitalized when they're sick or having issues with at risk for developmental delays or, again, having these growth problems. And so I think it's really important to think about kind of a continuum from being stably housed to homelessness and that there are millions of children that fall in between those that are housing insecure.
What age group is most seriously impacted?
You know, that is a great question. We've done some actually new research looking at the prenatal period. So looking at how homelessness may affect you either when your mom was pregnant with you versus as a young child. And we found actually huge impacts in the prenatal period where even after controlling for a lot of different exposures and things like that, that you were much more likely to say be a low birth weight baby or to have been born prematurely, born before 37 weeks. And those things we know are tied to lifetime economic potential. And so that we've really started to focus on the prenatal period as being a really critical to brain growth and to health in general. That being said, I also really focus a lot on young children as being an important impact. But let's acknowledge that housing impacts you across the lifespan, whether it be school age, adolescence, or adulthood.
What is the point, Dr. Sandel, at which a family crosses into the zone that's really dangerous for young children?
Well, it it definitely depends for each family. We talk a lot now about these hardships, that housing insecurity is one of many hardships that families face. So we also talk about food insecurity, the ability to afford enough food on a regular basis that's healthy and nutritious. And then also this concept of energy insecurity. Are you able to pay your light bill and your heat bill, and you're not having to, say, be threatened with a shut off or being shut off electricity or having to use, say, your stove to heat in the wintertime? And what our research has shown is that when you have all three of those hardships, that's like synergistically bad. It's like almost like this bad dose response. And so oftentimes, more and more, we talk about how these programs have multiple benefits, so that, say, a food subsidy program may actually help you stay in your house because you're then able to spend money on rent, that energy subsidies can actually make you more likely to afford good food, or that a housing subsidy may make you, even if you're having trouble affording food, it may make you less likely to have stunted growth.
You know, life is stressful enough, particularly when raising kids, particularly when there's a partial government shutdown, particularly when the economy is challenging. But if you're looking at a situation where you can't heat your home in the winter and you're deciding between food and rent, I would think the stress level would mount so severely that you might have perhaps an increase in cases of domestic violence. Do you see that?
Yeah, it's interesting. There definitely is, I think, stress is a really important pathway. And I think more and more we're understanding the biology of why poverty makes people sicker. I mean, we've acknowledged that for many years. And now more and more, they're literally describing kind of how it affects your stress hormones and other things, and that can have a lifetime effect. I think you're absolutely right that both domestic violence or actually child abuse and neglect, there's been good evidence that when poverty rates are higher, that those reports actually go up because people are feeling that stress. And it is kind of, unfortunately, a normal reaction to then not be able to do the good child development and stimulation that we know all kids need.
How does a family's financial situation impact children's health? Particularly, I understand your research actually shows that simply being behind on rent can impact the health of children.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, more and more I've talked about kind of housing as being a vital sign, right? So when you go to see your doctor, they'll take your blood pressure and they'll do your height and your weight. And we do those because those are important pieces of information that kind of change our management, and we think they're important for your health. And more I talk about being able to ask simple questions about your housing, like where do you stay? Is it safe? Are you behind on your rent? Because what our research has found is that being behind on rent can be almost as bad for you as being in a homeless shelter, because it's such a marker for having to make those trade-offs that are really bad for child health. And so that when we think about kind of what that means, it is kind of an important call for affordable housing being a medical intervention, that when there are communities where the waiting lists are 10 years, that's a marker that the population health is at risk because there aren't enough places for people to be able to have their rent paid for.
This all seems very obvious when you explain it this way, and yet I've got to believe that this has not always been the way medicine has been practiced with low-income populations. Am I right?
Yeah, it is interesting. I was at a meeting recently with our regional health and human service secretary, and she actually called me an aberration because I am a doctor who cares about housing. I think that it'll be interesting under the Affordable Care Act, more and more medicine is going to have to acknowledge that the social determinants of health may be as important as the biologic determinants or even the psychologic determinants of health. I think that we've always been really good at the biologic determinants, but I think we're going to have to more and more acknowledge the social determinants and start thinking about ways to intervene in them. I think that, you know, I would love to see a day where hospitals and health centers were lobbying for more affordable housing because it was good for their patients. And I think that, you know, that's what we view our role at Children's Health Watch is we're bringing the evidence to show that these programs work, that these are good for patients, and that therefore we really want to bring evidence into the policy conversation.
She might call you an aberration. Others might call you an inspiration.
Yeah. Well, I say that I want to not be an aberration any longer, right? Like, I want it to be, instead of...
It's lonely out there, right?
Well, are saying, why are you asking about housing? Why aren't you asking about housing? Like, in many ways, like, that may be the best thing that you do. I mean, certainly when we think about things like, you know, even something like food insecurity, 50 million people are food insecure in our country. 26 million have diabetes, 26 million have hypertension or heart disease. Those aren't mutually exclusive numbers. Like,
no, those dots need to be connected, no question.
And so when we think about it, like, you know, many people, we know there's a huge affordable housing gap. And so that, you know, our ability to ask simple questions, even if we're not able to provide affordable housing right away, it is really important for us to understand that as a risk factor for our patients and then be able to do whatever we can to try and mitigate those problems.
You mentioned food insecurity. In your prior research, what results did you find when food stamps were taken away from children?
Yeah, it is really interesting. I think that it's we were trying to look at housing insecurity, right? This marker of people having bad health because they're, say, having to move frequently and be overcrowded. And we looked at how a housing subsidy can obviously impact that. And no surprise, having a housing subsidy makes you much less likely to be housing insecure. But what we were surprised about was the idea that having a housing subsidy with a food subsidy like SNAP or WIC then actually enhanced the ability of that housing subsidy to make you housing insecure, even compared to just the housing subsidy alone. And then we looked at if you had a housing subsidy taken away, again, no surprise that you were less likely to be housing secure. But when you take away the food subsidy, you're less likely to be housing secure as well. And so that these benefit programs are important to think about together. And many times these families are eligible for them, right? They have the same income requirements, and yet oftentimes there's inefficiencies, right? You have to go to two different places. You have to provide two different sets of documentations when you could streamline that system and make it a lot more efficient.
I can't even imagine negotiating these systems if English isn't your first language. I was on disability this year, and I swear I didn't have enough degrees to be able to manage the system and get the benefits for which I was eligible. So,
yeah, it is interesting. I mean, one of the things that I do is something called medical legal partnership, which is this idea of integrating legal services into the healthcare setting, because so many systems now are so complicated. And so you may ask a question like, why would a pediatrician need a lawyer? Like, that seems crazy. And yet what we know is that we think 50 million people need legal care to be healthy. Like, they need access to, you know, legal information because every system is so complicated. And this is where, you know, a social worker wants to have access to that lawyer because they can only do so much. But if they have that kind of right information, then they get what they're eligible for the first time instead of getting denied and then having to appeal and then getting it 6 months later when they've already had a lot of bad medical problems because of that denial.
And lost their house or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
What have you learned, Dr. Sandel, about the health of children who live in subsidized housing? Do you see better results?
What we've learned about children who live in subsidized housing is that subsidized housing can almost be a buffer against bad effects. So this is some research that Alan Myers led, and we published it in 2005 in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine. And what we showed was if you had a family that was, say, food insecure or hungry, and that placed them at really severe risk of having stunted growth, if they were receiving a housing subsidy, they were much more likely, like twofold more likely, to have a normal size child, a child that wasn't stunted, than the family that was eligible for that housing subsidy, was food insecure, but was sitting on a waiting list for affordable housing. And so that's part of the reason I talk about housing as a vaccine. It not only keeps you healthy now, but it protects you in the future from future kind of insults or assaults on your health. And so that's where I think it just becomes really important to think about why this investment is so critical to our nation's health.
You're a member of the National Committee on Housing and Health with people like Henry Cisneros. Is there frustration at that level, Dr. Sandel, with national housing policy or the lack of attention to affordable housing at the federal level?
Well, I think that we haven't done enough of the conversation around bringing the evidence into play. Like, I think that I've heard Chris Estes, who's the director of the National Housing Conference, talk about the lack of affordable housing and people thinking that it's it just kind of happened. And yet, when we think about it, if we're able to plan better and think about what affordable housing brings to a community, we should be changing the discussion about not only what are the effects of bringing affordable housing, but what's the effects of us not bringing affordable housing? And so that I think that when we try and think about housing quality, making that so that that's a standard across the country, so it's not different in Arkansas where they don't have a habitability standard at all, versus a place where I work in Massachusetts that has a really strong habitability standard that makes it a lot easier to have a family live in a decent house. And so I think that we have to have a better national housing policy. We have to have a better conversation about why housing matters. And we have to talk about it not only in the sense of what does the evidence tell us around why this is a great investment for kids, but that it's also about, you know, what are we missing now? Like, we're trying to close an achievement gap in schools, and yet we know that kids don't learn as well if they're moving frequently. They oftentimes have to repeat a grade. And so that we should be thinking about housing as a way to improve our education outcomes as much as our health outcomes and economic outcomes.
They're all interdependent.
They all work together. And I think that it's interesting when we think about what the health impact of policies are, we often think about what does this policy bring? What are the pros and cons? But more and more, I want us to think about what's the health impact of doing nothing, because we haven't done enough. And so we tend to not think about what costs are we paying now in terms of healthcare costs or education costs by our inaction as much as trying to drive us to drive towards new actions.
How can organizations like Home Matters contribute to the policy debate, and more importantly, to contribute to fixing the problem?
Yeah, I think that really trying to help people understand why homes are so essential to health is going to be part of it. And we at Children's Health Watch really want to try and bring that evidence to the base so that people can say, look, there is research that this helps young children. It's not just a theoretical. And that I think that part of it is going to be the evidence, but then part of it is about bringing those stories. You know, I, as a pediatrician, see every day how housing matters for my patients. And I want to bring more and more healthcare and educators and people who aren't the usual kind of advocates talking about why home matters. And hopefully, as we build a broader coalition, it's not going to be a matter of questioning, does a housing matter? But saying, yes, a home matters and we need to invest in it because we're going to see a payoff in the future.
Dr. Sandel, if our listeners are interested in learning more on the subject or on getting involved, where might you direct them online?
Well, we have a great research website called Children's Health Watch, .org. That's where all of our articles are. And we work really hard not only to publish in the medical literature, so we have kind of more complicated explanations of our research, but we also work really hard to have policy briefs. And so we have a simple language 4-pager about why affordable housing is so important as a prescription for hunger. Or we have housing briefs from our 5 sites that Children's Health Watch collects data. So Minnesota, Arkansas, Baltimore, Maryland, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and in Boston, Massachusetts, where we talk about what our research in those sites is showing about the gap for affordable housing. And those are really meant as policy tools for advocates so that they can be able to use the research in their advocacy efforts to talk about why home matters. And then I also work for its medical-legal partnership, allonword.org, and that talks about these models where you're integrating legal care into the healthcare setting. There are over 300 hospitals and health centers that are doing that across the country, and that website can talk more about that model if you want more information.
So once again, that first website that you gave us was childrenshealthwatch.org.
Yep, childrenshealthwatch.org, and then medical-legalpartnership.org.
Great. Dr. Megan Sandel, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Boston University Schools of Medicine and Public Health and Co-Principal Investigator with Children's Health Watch, thank you so much for your comments and insights today.
Thank you for having me.
To hear other episodes of the Affordable Housing Podcast, please visit edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.